Well, thanks very much, Chris, and thank you all for being here. It's indeed a great pleasure to be here again, I should say. As Chris was saying, the challenges that the world faces and that we lay out in the book cannot really be addressed by the traditional means of security policy, by raising military spending, dispatching troops, sealing borders. And I found it quite interesting. I was in a meeting with the Norwegian defense minister just about a week ago, and Norway had just decided to, in effect, reinforce its military presence in Afghanistan as part of the Allied effort. But the defense minister said, you know, I'd really rather see my civilian colleagues come in and step up. If we can send more foresters to Afghanistan and people like that, we can start withdrawing soldiers. And I think that was really, in a nutshell, I think, quite a clear point of the kinds of shifts, the kinds of priorities that we need to take far more seriously. I think part of the problem that we're facing is that by continuing with traditional military priorities, we are in effect threatening to sideline some of the very important struggles for environmental stability, for social stability, and so on. And we are in effect draining resources away from these efforts. In the year 2000, the members of the United Nations agreed to the so-called Millennium Development Goals, a set of goals which I think would really get us a long way toward where we need to be. 2 years later, in Johannesburg, these goals were complemented by a set of environmental goals as well. But in assessing where we are today with regard to the Millennium Development Goals, the Johannesburg goals, we find that progress really is quite slow. It's quite uneven when you look around the world from region to region, when you look at one goal to the next goal. It's a very, very slow, uneven progress. And I think we have to do far better than that. Relatively modest investments could help to break some of the vicious destabilizing cycles that we see in operation. Rough estimates, and these are principally by UN agencies, suggest that to provide clean drinking water and sewage systems might cost something on the order of $37 billion per year over a number of years. Cutting world hunger in half might require something like $24 billion. There are a set of other estimates like these, and if you add them up in the environmental and in the social arena, you may end up with something like $100 billion per year in terms of investment need, critical investment need. Now, that's clearly a very substantial sum, but compare that with what has already been spent on the Iraq war and, of course, the ongoing effort to resolve the situation in that country. Already $150 billion have been spent, and just for this calendar year, 2005, an additional $80 billion has been asked for by the Bush administration. So I think it's a clear indication that the resources per se are available. The question is, what are our priorities? Can we shift our priorities? There is, in effect, a second investment deficit, because not only do we need to realize that there are broader underlying forces that destabilize the world, but I think we also have to take care of, in effect, the legacies of the past. We have to deal with issues like the need for disarmament, controlling dangerous weapons and weapons materials, strengthening peacekeeping capabilities, pursuing post-conflict reconstruction. In this regard as well, we are investing, we have efforts, we have programs in place. But taking a step aside, I think we have, in effect, an investment deficit. We are not doing enough. So overall, it seems to us that the world's investment priorities, the world's security spending is largely misdirected. We are now spending almost $1 trillion worldwide on military programs. That is very close, actually, to the peak levels that were achieved during the Cold War years. Now, if we accept that we need to have a broader security agenda. I think it also follows that we really have a broader set of opportunities. We can promote, particularly Chris had already pointed out, energy policy is a very critical area. We can do far better in terms of promoting renewables, in promoting energy efficiency, safeguarding critical ecosystems, reducing population growth, making also critical investments in education and job training, and strengthening public health systems. But I think what's most important is not to create a very long list of programs and issues that need to be addressed, but rather to understand that we have to work more in cross-cutting, more in interdisciplinary ways. We have to bring together the different insights and strengths of policy communities, of academic specialties, and so on. We also have to work better to integrate the global and national and local levels. Of course, starting with UN reform, strengthening the United Nations, as the report of the high-level panel has argued that UN Secretary General Kofi Annan had put in place. I think by pursuing these more cross-cutting ways, we're far more likely to make headway in all of these regards with regard to energy policy, health policy, environmental policy. Let me finish with one particular area that my colleagues and I felt was a very exciting area, a very exciting chapter in the book, and that is the notion of environmental peacemaking. The basic idea here is that cooperative efforts to manage cross-boundary environmental resources can help to create more peaceful relations among states, particularly those states that usually are in either very uneasy or perhaps even adversarial relationships. And we have certainly so far seen a range of initiatives, including so-called peace parks along boundaries, shared river basin management plans, regional seas agreements, and joint environmental monitoring programs. And I think we will see more of these initiatives. Underlying, I think, is the idea that the environment offers a very useful and perhaps a unique set of qualities that lend themselves to build confidence, mutual confidence, and to build peace. Environmental challenges ignore political boundaries. They require a long-term perspective. And they encourage and necessitate the participation of local groups, community groups, along with governments, along with international organizations. The hope in these efforts is, of course, that mutual trust can be built up, that more cooperative habits can be established, and that over time, that these low-level, low-key working relationships will actually translate into a sense of, yes, we can work together, we can resolve the issues that really bring us together rather than divide us. We can really do this together. So the basic idea is really that a new dynamic will emerge from these environmental peacemaking efforts. The book details some specifics, I won't go into the details here, but I think one of the challenges ahead of us now is to realize that these are not only issues that concern sets of states and interstate relations, but we also have to work in similar ways below the national level to bring together different groups within states that are competing over tight water resources and other environmental resources. I think the tsunami in the Indian Ocean was one particular example where, of course, in Sri Lanka and in Aceh, warring groups, or I should say governments and groups, sub-state groups that were at war with one another, where suddenly an opportunity arose and a need arose to work together and to see to it that this opportunity can translate into a larger peacemaking effort. I'll leave it right there. Thanks very much.